wondering what to do next. Enter, knock, and enter. Go away. Did he have a woman in there? I didn't think he was married. He didn't have the look of a married man, but he might well be indulging in a little light entertainment to round off the day. Or perhaps last night had been a one-off and I was now back in the public domain. I hesitated, and while I stood undecided, he opened the door and motioned me inside. The stool sat in the middle of the room. He pointed sternly and I sat down before I fell down. Crossing to his wooden chest, he rummaged for a while and then pulled out a cloth-wrapped bundle, which he carefully unwrapped. Inside were three small wooden boxes, each made of a different wood. He picked up the smallest and opened it, releasing a pleasant, almost pepperminty smell. The box contained a pale green salve. He held out his hand for mine. I was too tired to argue. He carefully peeled off my makeshift bandage, examining the raw patches carefully. I remembered how important it was not to get an infection in this time. Tiny wounds that could safely be ignored in my time could be very dangerous in this. No, I had to remind myself. This was my time now. This was when I lived. This was my life. Get used to it. True, as a member of St. Mary's, all my jabs were up to date, but we needed to renew them regularly, and that wouldn't happen now. I needed to watch for sepsis, tetanus, and God knows what else. While I'd been thinking about this, he'd carefully cleaned the wounds and anointed them with a tiny amount of salve, which tingled slightly but not unpleasantly. He did the same with the other hand. To my surprise, he handed me back the blood-stained strips of cloth. Of course, everything had value. I could wash them out and use them again. Protection for my hands. To tie up my hair. Anything. I would never throw anything away again. I was the woman who had nothing. Not even a comb for my hair. And sooner or later, the period-preventing injections I had every 6 months would wear off, and that would be something else to cope with. But other women managed. So would I. I could find a stick to keep my teeth clean. And I could bathe in the stream, and wash my clothes there too. I would survive, somehow. Until 1403, anyway. Chapter 18. The second day was a repeat of the first, except that I was on the hay wagon all day, and we only worked for half a day because the rain came down after lunch. Back at St. Mary's, I didn't know what to do with myself. Everyone seemed to have some function or purpose. Everyone scuttled busily to and fro, finding something to do, and I had nothing. I stood uncertainly in the gatehouse doorway, watching the rain run down the roofs and splash into the muddy yard below. The midden continued to steam, even in the downpour. The chickens had taken cover. People splashed back and forth, calling to each other. I was just turning to go back upstairs when there was a shout from the other side of the yard. Walter and William wanted to see me. I knew better than to keep them waiting. I hoisted my skirt and galloped across the yard, dodging the deeper-looking puddles. It's no problem getting wet if there are hot baths and dry clothes at the end of the day, but getting wet and having to live in those clothes for the next 24 hours is no joke. Under Walter's close scrutiny and even closer questioning, I repeated my story. They'd obviously been mulling it over between them. As far as I could see from their body language, Walter was still deeply suspicious of me. William Hendred spoke first. "You will remain with us for the time being." I bowed my head. "God's blessing be upon you both." Walter snorted. I pretended not to hear. "You will work for your keep." I nodded, channeling strong, sturdy medieval womanhood. I would have preferred to be an honoured guest, but an unpaid servant was better than nothing. I would have food on the table and a roof over my head. Well, William Hendred's roof over my head. I think, somewhere, someone had decided I wasn't making any meaningful contribution to the haymaking process, and the next day I was put on what initially I thought were light duties. I was up with the sun, waiting in my room for William Hendred to finish his ablutions so I could begin mine. I soon learned not to drink anything after late evening. Beer goes through me faster than a politician through his expense account. Once he'd banged the door behind him, I was off, dock leaf in hand, to avail myself of the latest thing in public facilities. A quick splash in the water trough, and then, closing my mind to the lack of Leon-bearing tea, I was ready for anything. First up were the chickens, feathery and malevolent at the best of times, all of whom were grumpy at being woken so early and would take it out on me. I could see why the poultryman had embraced delegation with enthusiasm. An extra half hour in bed and the prospect of getting through the rest of the day unbeaked. I would chivvy a large number of disgruntled birds out into the fresh air, rather like my old games teacher cattle-prodding 30 unenthusiastic schoolgirls into sub-zero temperatures for a refreshing bout of blood-stained hockey, feed said chickens without losing a leg or an eye, and then, while they were busy, nip back into the henhouse to collect the eggs. I'd take the eggs to the kitchen for the head cook, a massive, tow-headed, red, sweaty man who was generally known either as Fat Piers or That Bastard, depending on how his day was going. Hands on hips, he would hold me responsible for the disappointing number of eggs reposing on his table. In the first week, I stood meekly, head bowed, and then one day I caught a couple of the scullions smirking at each other and cottoned on. Next morning, I presented the eggs and stood and grinned at him. He shouted, I grinned some more. He paused, things hung in the balance for a moment. Then he too grinned gummily and made a get out of my kitchen gesture. I dumped the basket and ran. I would draw endless buckets of water for the washerwoman, Marjorie Dore, a brawny woman with forearms like hams and fists to match, who was sporadically assisted by a waif named Little Alice, who was barely tall enough to see over the vats, so I was the one doing most of the heavy lifting. Occasionally, I think as some sort of reward, I was allowed to stir a vat of scummy water. Then I was off for a breakfast, usually of porridge, and then back to help the two of them spread their washing over the bushes to dry in the sun. The next task was to take a midday meal up through the village to Father Ranulph, the elderly priest, now half-blind, and his even older and frailer housekeeper, Dame Rowena. It would seem that he and she had been together for years. I suspected he was the younger son of a good household, and that either just before or just after his ordination there had been some Rowena-related scandal, and he'd been dispatched to this remote place. Out of sight and out of mind. I think it had been a stroke of luck for all concerned, and he'd arrived here as a young priest, bringing his housekeeper with him, and the village had been the gainer because he was a conscientious and compassionate man with slightly less hair than Dr. Bairstow, which is to say, none at all. I was lucky. His Latin was excellent. Many local priests had virtually no Latin at all. They'd learned the services by rote years ago and were sometimes unintelligible. Rowena had been beautiful. You could see it in her fine bones and patrician profile. The poor soul was crippled by arthritis these days, her fingers twisted into uselessness, hence me taking them up their midday meal and making the return trip with the used dishes from the day before. I would also take the opportunity to sweep around their house, tidy a little, and empty their pots for them, and in return they taught me a few useful words and phrases in the local dialect. Weather permitting, we would sit on a bench against the church wall and talk in a strange mixture of medieval English and Latin, with me relapsing into modern English and mime under stress. They laughed a lot. I think they thought I was hilarious. Sometimes they poured out beakers of something apple-flavoured, and then things became even more hilarious, and I often had trouble getting back down the hill. In the afternoon, I would sweep my room, William Hendred's room, and the gatehouse stairs, often meeting his men-at-arms as I did so. They always stepped aside politely, which surprised me. I wondered if they thought I was his property, and were therefore keeping their hands to themselves. I tried to feel that this was a good thing. After I'd tidied our rooms, it was back to take in the washing for Marjorie, who herself was often incapable by this time of day. There was never any sign of Little Alice at this hour. I had no idea where she took herself off to. Out of kindness, Rowena had given me a drop spindle for which she had no more use because her fingers couldn't cope any longer. She'd spent a couple of hours trying to instill the basics, and when I felt I was well enough advanced I thought I'd have a go in public, I sat on the bench by the gatehouse door and practiced my spinning. I was rubbish. To this day, I'm convinced the stupid thing was defective. Sitting in the sun, I assembled my bit of practice fleece, hooked on the spindle, let the fleece rest over the back of my left hand as she'd shown me, and cockily gave it a twirl. A nice thread appeared, and greatly encouraged, I teased out a little more of the fleece and gave it another go. I'm not sure what happened. I think I overspun, or possibly underspun. Let's face it, there's only two ways it could go. Anyway, the yarn parted, and the spindle dropped heavily to the ground. Presumably that's why it's called a drop spindle, although in my case, thud spindle would be more appropriate. I sighed and reached down to pick it up, caught a movement out of the corner of my eye, and looked up to find William Hendred, hands on hips, watching me from a few yards away. I gave him my, "Yes, can I help you look?" But he just shook his head and walked away. I practiced constantly. I had to. This was not an age when women sat around and did nothing. If they weren't ploughing a 10-acre strip with a teaspoon while 8 months pregnant, or delivering a breached calf in a thunderstorm, or brewing something dark, bubbling and unspeakable, or shrieking at their countless children, then they were spinning. And you didn't catch them scowling in concentration, or cursing under their breath, or grappling with yarn that looked like a string of badly stuffed sausages. These women sat, coiffed heads close together, their tongues as busy as their fingers, chatting, watching their children over their shoulders, and doing 100 other things at the same time. They were friendly. I was sometimes invited to join them as they sat outside Pikey Peter's house, waiting for their bread to bake in the public oven. Pikey Peter was the enormous lad who had greeted me at the gate on the day I arrived. He'd been a big, strong and handsome lad, the apple of his widowed mother's eye, until the grave he was digging one day had collapsed on him. He had been working alone, and by the time they got him out, he'd been buried for too long. Now he was capable of only the very simplest tasks, and his great strength was not the blessing it had once been. But people rallied around. He was given work to do, lifting and carrying, and his exhausted mother, Edgitha, earned a little extra in the way of an egg or two or a small bundle of firewood by minding other people's bread as it baked in the oven outside her house. I sometimes hid a wrinkled apple or two in the bottom of my basket as I toiled up the hill and left them on her doorstep. Anyway, I sat with them if I'd finished my tasks early, and occasionally, out of polite exasperation, I think, one of them would take my spindle and twirl it expertly for me, and sorting out the tangle I'd managed to get myself into. Mostly I just listened, picking up words and phrases and listening to the gossip. Interestingly, no one liked Walter of Shrewsbury. He was generally reckoned to be a hard man. William Hendred they seemed to like. I once asked if he was from Castle Hendred, across the country, but either they didn't know or more likely my accent defeated them. Hugh Armstrong was an unknown quantity. He'd never spent much time at St. Mary's. As a young boy, he'd gone into service to John of Gaunt's son, Henry Bolingbroke, soon to be King Henry if he wasn't already, and had remained with him ever since, sharing his exile. I gathered from their talk that news of Henry's landing at Ravenspur had not yet reached them. Again I would stare at my feet and wonder what to do. And that was my dilemma, of course. Summer was passing, and it was all going to kick off any day now. I would look around the peaceful village at the, if not happy, then at least reasonably contented, people living there, their cottages and livestock, their carefully tilled strips of land. It wasn't a rich village, but it was reasonably prosperous. I was getting to know some of them. Enormous John Smith and his countless equally enormous sons working at their forge down by the stream, near the stepping stones. Miserable Robert Stukely, who ran the mill and would cheat you blind as soon as look at you. Nearly opposite, on the other side of the stream, lived Margaret Brewer, whose ale was so good they came for miles around for it. Assisted by her daughter, Big Alice, she lived and brewed almost on the same spot the Falkenberg Arms would occupy some 650 years from now. And there was William the Carpenter, the two kitchen boys, Roger and Edgar, who might have been brothers. Fat Piers the cook, I've already mentioned, and there was Dick, the tall scullion boy, and the other one whose name I could never remember, but whose face was an explosion of acne, and Wymer and Cuthbert, the stable boys, who loudly and cheerfully pursued every girl in sight, and who would be terrified if they ever caught one. They were kindly people, hard-working, devout. Most of them worshipped daily, and even I traipsed off to church on Sunday, significantly failing to burst into flames on the threshold. I would spend the service staring around at the brilliantly painted walls and statues, kneeling and crossing myself at the appropriate moments, always half a beat behind everyone else, as Father Ranulph celebrated Mass. I had a great respect and liking for them all, and I thought, well, I hoped, that they had some liking for me. I worked hard. I cantered up and down to the village 20 times a day. I was polite and respectful to everyone. And then came the day when I wondered if I'd been kidding myself. It was early morning. I was delivering today's eggs to the kitchen. Everyone was yawning and stretching, poking the fires back into life, and laying out platters and beakers for breakfast. I dumped the eggs on the table, turned to go, and bumped straight into a man who smelled of urine and onions. Not an attractive combination in any age. It was the gate guard I'd met on my first day here, the one who had left Pikey Peter in charge while he got his head down. For a couple of days afterwards, he'd walked around with a split lip. Medieval discipline as administered by William Hendrett.
"Ah,"
he said, taking advantage to run his hands over me. I stiffened. There were very definite rules about touching women. Basically, if a woman wasn't a relation, then you didn't. I, of course, had no relations. There were no men here to protect me. He laughed. I didn't catch everything he said, but I did get, "Be woman without master." Oh, God, was that what they called me? The masterless woman? That wasn't good at all. Men come in many shapes and forms. Bottom of the heap is always the greasy, inadequate runt with a sense of entitlement who can't quite understand that all women are not gagging for him. And this one was the bottom of even that heap. The sort of bloke you'd use to line your budgie cage. The sort who grabs a woman by whichever bit of her anatomy is most easily accessible, and when she struggles, tells her he likes a woman with spirit until you kick him in the nadgers and it turns out that he doesn't. Things can then go one of two ways. Either he oozes away and rejoins the primordial slime, or he lays in wait until you're alone and far from help. I was always alone. I could be in trouble here. I compromised by kicking his shins. He hopped backwards, cursing, and then came back at me with a raised fist. I was preparing to defend myself with a small wicker basket when there was a noise. I can't describe it, but in the silence that followed, I looked around to find that it had been the sort of noise made by everyone in the vicinity picking up the nearest implement and assuming a nasty look. There was never any doubt as to which way things would go, and with a face-saving glare, he seized a loaf off the table and barged his way out of the door. I picked up my basket and prepared to follow him out. Dick, the tall, skinny scullion, touched my arm and shook his head. I chose to interpret that as a message to let him get clear. He handed me a small beaker and nodded to a stool near the giant fireplace. I put down my basket and sat. My legs were trembling. Good idea. The beaker was half full of very weak beer, which, and you wouldn't think this possible, tastes even worse than beer that isn't very weak. However, I sipped slowly, leaving the traditional small amount in the bottom so I wouldn't have to see what the beer had failed to dissolve. Yes, that had been one small bad incident among many good ones, but it was the moment I realized I was part of this community. I didn't rank very highly because he was right. I was a masterless woman, with all the problems that entailed, but I knew them all, and they were beginning to know me. I was the foreign woman, the one who had lost everything, and they generously forgave my eccentricities and incompetence. They had taken me in and made my life much easier than it could have been, and there was one way I could repay them. I could find someone and make him listen to me. I could repay my debt to them, and if history didn't like it, then that was just tough. I discounted Walter of Shrewsbury immediately. Even I didn't have that much of a death wish. so it was not without some misgivings that I placed myself in front of William Hendred as he emerged from the stables one afternoon. Remembering my womanly duty to look chaste, obedient, respectful, humble, and dutiful, none of which came naturally, I clasped my hands before me and said, "God give you good day, sir. May I speak?" He had been standing in the sun, chewing a straw, and, I suspected, just taking a moment to enjoy the day. It wasn't a great moment, but as Walter had pushed off to harass someone somewhere else, it seemed as good a time as any. William Hendred was a man of very few words, but I was beginning to understand his expressions. He regarded me with a familiar mixture of exasperation and faint amusement. Taking the straw from his mouth, he nodded. I looked around, but no one was nearby. It was a hot afternoon. Most people were indoors for one reason or another. One of the stable cats was slumped on the roof, fast asleep. The doves cooed peacefully from their dovecot. The chickens had dug themselves little scrapes in the shade and were dozing. There was a faint clatter of pots from the kitchens, but Fat Piers would be fast asleep somewhere. Everyone was off having a reasonably peaceful afternoon. I took a deep breath and assembled my Latin. "Sir, I tried to tell you when first I came here." I stopped. He still said nothing, just looking down at me. The sun was behind him, so I couldn't see his face. I ploughed on anyway. "When I was in Rushford, there was an inn. I worked there for 2 days." I stopped again. I could imagine what he was thinking, that if I served ale as incompetently as I did everything else, then it was a miracle I'd lasted even that long. Well, that was fine with me. "Some men were talking. They were drunk. They said something about St. Mary's. I did not pay attention to begin with." He still said nothing. "They kept calling for more ale. The landlord made them show him their money. They had plenty of money." I paused again in case he wanted to tell me to stop wasting his time and sweep me aside, but he didn't. "Sir, they were talking of riding here in force. They said the king is seizing Lancaster lands, that all is forfeit to the crown." He knew this. I'd seen those anxious conversations between him and Walter, the lookouts on the road. They were waiting for the arrival of the king's commissioners. Admittedly, this was a very small estate, and they would take a long time to get here, but, as far as they knew, one day they would come. One day St. Mary's would pass from the exiled Duke of Lancaster and into the hands of the king. The problem was that they were all looking the wrong way. It wasn't the king they had to worry about. Trouble would come from an unexpected direction, and I owed it to them to do my best to warn them. He said in his slow, deep voice, "The king is in Ireland."
"That is why they waited, sir."
"Why?"
"They plan to take St. Mary's before the king returns, to take advantage of both the king's absence and that of Sir Hugh Armstrong. When the king returns, he will have more important things to do than worry about one small manor. They think we are minor and unprotected, that taking us will be easy."
He stared at me for a while and then gestured with his head. We stepped into the shade.
"When did you hear this?"
"The day before I arrived here, sir."
"Why did you not speak of this before?"
"I tried, sir, on the day you took me in, but Master Walter was displeased, and I did not wish to anger him further."
I felt a faint stirring at the back of my neck, which could have been either a gentle summer breeze or history preparing to wipe me from the face of the earth. Although, to be fair, the most threatening thing around at the moment was the stable cat, a terror to the rodent population and a legendary lover currently flat out on the roof, but more than capable of taking me on.
"How many of them?"
I struck out at random.
4, sir."
4 seemed a good number.
"And their badge?"
"I did not recognize it."
"Describe it."
Now I was stuck. I had no idea what Guy of Rushford's badge was.
I shook my head. "I cannot."
That's one of the best things about being a member of the weaker sex. In modern days, they'd say disbelievingly, "Oh, come on, you must have noticed something about them." But in these times, we women were subject to all sorts of womb-induced humours that daily deprived us of the ability to think, to reason, and in my case,
to notice what had apparently been in front of my own nose all evening. I had to think of something. The landlord said I was to serve them quickly because they were Guy's men and used to getting what they wanted.
Guy of Rushford?
Yes, I said, apparently remembering. They were Guy's men and wanted the best of everything.
He looked at me, hard-eyed.
And did they get it? I knew what he was asking. Barmaids didn't dispense just drinks. I lowered my eyes and said in a tiny voice, they didn't want it.
A perfectly reasonable response, I thought. At my age, I was resigned to working my way down men's lists of shaggable women, without ever having been that high up in the first place.
When I looked up again, he was smiling his crooked smile. And then he wasn't.
How many men? And when?
I racked my brains to remember what Dr. Dowson had told me about the history of St. Mary's, that the manor of St. Mary's had been bestowed by John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, in return for services rendered during the Castile campaign, that the Rushford branch of the family, consisting of the two brothers, Guy and Gerald, and I believe there was a sister around somewhere, had sought to capitalise on the chaos brought about by the king's attempted seizure of Lancaster lands and sought to annex this manor. They'd been repulsed by, if I remembered correctly, a strategic fire set by Henry of Rushford's granddaughter. Well, that bit was wrong. Even if Hugh Armstrong was Henry's son or grandson, there was no granddaughter living here. That wouldn't be the first St. Mary's legend we'd got wrong. I still had nightmares about 1643, when St. Mary's went up in flames and Markham, trapped on the roof, had the choice between jumping and burning. My story was true, but would William Hendred believe me? He was not a stupid man. He'd obviously heard of the king's attempts to seize the Lancaster estates and was expecting trouble of some kind. He had lookouts on the main road, the only road, actually, in and out of the village. He might listen to me. Walter wouldn't, I knew. I could just hear him muttering on about hysterical women, but William might. He did. We sat on the bench while he questioned me closely. How many men? What were they wearing? What was the name of the inn? What exactly had I overheard? Considering I was making it all up, I thought I did pretty well, inventing various villainous-looking characters who goosed the barmaids and raucously spilled their drinks. I remembered not to remember everything, because that's always suspicious, and after half an hour I think he believed me. He sent me away, and I had to shoot off anyway because it was time for me to sweep out the gatehouse. I left him sitting, deep in thought, on the bench by the door. I know he spoke to Walter of Shrewsbury about what I'd told him, because I saw the two of them talking together outside the stables. As I passed, laden with two buckets of water, they broke off and stared at me. I modestly averted my eyes from the sight of two men thinking deeply, making important decisions and doing other things my tiny female brain couldn't possibly hope to comprehend, and went off to be bullied by the chickens again. Medieval life is not all wafting about in a long gown, wearing gauzy veils and riding side-saddle on a prancing milk-white palfrey, you know. I was growing to hate those bloody chickens. Chapter 19. No one would tell me what was going on. I wondered if Walter still suspected I was some sort of royal spy, but I know William increased the number of lookouts on the road. I'm certain he'd sent men to Rushford as well, to watch and listen. St. Mary's became a flurry of activity and preparation. John fired up his smithy, and the sound of hammer on metal echoed around the village night and day as they repaired old weapons and forged new ones. Possessions were gathered up and packed away, including the precious glass from the windows. The tiny corridor between the hall and the solar was blocked off and converted into a strong room. This was where they packed the St. Mary's treasures, wool, plate, glass, documents, spices, and so on. When the tiny space was as full as it could be, they bricked up the other end and dragged a heavy wooden cupboard in front of it. Older children and livestock began to disappear into the woods. The pigs went first, driven off under the trees. Then most of the poultry and the chickens, crammed into small wooden cages and highly indignant. I think such valuables as the villagers possessed were quietly buried in their gardens for safekeeping.
I wondered exactly what items they considered worth saving in this century. In the Great Fire of London, Samuel Pepys buried his cheeses. I can't remember if he ever found them again. William and Walter walked around daily, William encouraging and urging, and Walter finding fault. Men scowled at his retreating back, but did as they were told. Walter had lived his entire adult life here, and no one could fault his commitment to St. Mary's. He was a 14th century Dr. Bairstow, and William Hendred was his Guthrie. I tried not to think about that. Painful stabs of homesickness could still bring tears to my eyes if not firmly kept at bay. And I knew from experience that once I started down that route, it was a very short step to Leon and Matthew and panic and disorientation and despair and grief, with tears and snot and all the unpleasant aftermath of a huge crying jag. So I didn't think about it. And it's not as if I didn't have alternative concerns. We were all about to be invaded. I knew the attack would not prevail, but all I knew were history book details. Attempts to steal the manor of St. Mary's were repulsed, etc., etc. I had no idea who would live and who would die. Nowhere was there a list of those who would not survive. People I had come to look on as my friends, Pikey Peter, Father Ranulph, John the Smith, the two stable lads and their incessant but easily rebuffed pursuit of anything in a skirt, Fat Piers and his noisy afternoon naps, and William Hendred, who was all that stood between me and the world. I thrust that thought away as well. They held weapons practice every afternoon. I could hear the clash of swords outside the gatehouse. All the men were expected to participate. Those who didn't have swords had staffs. There was daily archery practice too. Wandering through the courtyard one day with a bucket of chicken feed, I came upon a solitary staff propped against the wall. No one was around, and I couldn't think who it could belong to. I looked around again. Nope. No one. Setting down the bucket, I picked up the staff. It was a nice one, straight and balanced. It was obviously well used. Constant handling had worn the handhold smooth and shiny. I'm not bad with a staff. I once used a broom handle to knock 7 shades of shit out of a really unpleasant bloke called Weasel, who was annoying me at the time. This was longer and heavier and deadlier. I flexed my arms a couple of times, and then stabbed forward, parried an imaginary thrust, whirled it around at low level, scything the legs out from under my imaginary foe, and then, as he was lying helpless on the ground, stepped in for the kill. I felt a glow of satisfaction. I wasn't as out of practice as I had thought. Excessive spinning hadn't dulled too many of my reflexes. If I had to, I could defend myself. I had noticed there were fewer and fewer women around every day. I was still here, however, and no one had suggested evacuating me for my own safety. I wondered whether I wasn't valuable enough to be saved, or was simply thought too weird to be in any danger. Neither was particularly flattering. I carefully replaced the staff as I'd found it, picked up my bucket, turned around, and found myself face to face with William Hendred. Bollocks. We looked at each other for a while, and then I went to walk past him. He blocked my path. We looked at each other a little bit more. He picked up the staff with a familiarity that told me it was his. Again, bollocks. He held it out to me. I remember to put down the bucket and took it, my hands automatically taking up the correct position. It was far too late to pretend I thought it was just a stick. He disappeared around the corner, reappearing moments later with another staff. Standing in front of me, he nodded, grunted, and raised it high. I remembered Guthrie's training, but barely had time to get my feet sorted out before he attacked. Not hard and fast, but he was tons better than me, as he should be. I held my own for very nearly 5 whole seconds. Then the first blow caught me gently across the upper arm. I wondered if this was some kind of humiliating punishment for my unwomanly behaviour in touching his staff, his quarterstaff, before anyone gets the wrong idea. Drawn by the noise, a couple of men appeared from the gatehouse, and I was walloped across the other arm. Someone laughed. I stepped back. He lowered his staff. To my right, a man said something. I looked over. He mimed holding a staff, stabbed it forwards and stamped his right foot hard. The man next to him nodded. I looked back at William, who did exactly the same thing. I was doing something wrong. Slowly, I copied the movement, and then he came at me again. I stamped my foot down hard. All my weight was forwards. My staff flew under his guard and swept his own to one side, exposing the front of his body. I touched him gently on the chest. He laughed. They all laughed. He'd let me do it, obviously. He could have knocked the staff out of my hands at any time he wanted. I bowed, handed him back his staff, picked up the bucket, and went off to be beaten up by the chickens again. Chapter 20. They came the very next day. Two young girls, whose job was usually to keep an eye on the geese, came tearing up the hill, shouting breathlessly and gesturing over their shoulders. Someone fetched William Hendred, not that he was ever very far away these days. He handed them each a beaker of small beer, sat them on the bench outside the gatehouse, and waited. Walter of Shrewsbury was plying them with questions which, between gasping for breath and gulping down their drink, they had no chance of answering. William hushed him with a gesture and waited. He was very good at waiting. The youngest was the first to recover, with a babble of words and gestures I had no hope of understanding. William listened quietly, gave orders they were to be fed and seen safely on their way, and disappeared with Walter of Shrewsbury. 10 minutes later, it was as if someone had poked a wasp's nest. Accustomed as I was to our familiar St. Mary's shambles, I expected this to be rather similar. I was completely wrong. I wondered afterwards if they'd rehearsed for this, or maybe similar things happened all the time and it was second nature to them. Whatever it was, William barked a few orders and people scattered back to the village. Women emerged from their houses bearing bundles on their backs and chivying their children in front of them. Any remaining livestock were herded together, and what looked like almost everyone who had remained in the village headed for the forest. Ox-drawn wagons trundled their larger possessions, with those who couldn't walk sitting on the top. Everyone moved quickly, but there was no panic. Everyone knew what they were doing and where to go. I was a little ashamed of our shambolic St. Mary's fire drills, which never seemed to get any better, despite Leon's and Ian's best efforts. The last pens were emptied, and the long procession of people splashed across the ford, wound their way up the slope past St. Mary's and into the woods. Not knowing what to do, I stayed put by the gate and watched them go. They took less than 20 minutes to pass. I looked behind me into the courtyard. All the young boys who served in the castle had joined in the procession. The only people remaining were the two stable boys and a vastly reduced kitchen staff, who stood clustered together by the kitchen door. Fat Piers was clutching a kitchen implement in a way very similar to that perfected by Mrs. Mack some 6½ centuries later. I swallowed hard. I'm not sure if anyone's noticed, but wherever I go, there's always some catastrophe or other, and it's not always my fault. This one certainly wasn't, although I'd certainly done something to warrant the scowl William Hendred was wearing as he crossed the courtyard to me. I braced myself. Why did you not go with the others? I fell back on the traditional weak womanly excuse. No one told me to. He stared up towards the woods. The last stragglers were just disappearing under the eaves. Go! You can catch them! Go! I stepped back in case he wanted physically to reinforce his argument and shook my head. I couldn't go. It was vital I stayed here and steered events in the right direction, or so I told myself. He seized my arm and pushed me up the hill. He was a strong man. I staggered, and as I nearly fell, someone shouted. In the silence, I thought I could hear hooves. They were coming. I slipped behind him and back into St. Mary's, scurrying into the kitchen along with Fat Piers and his gang. Marjorie, the washerwoman, was there too. Well, if she could stay, then so could I. We looked each other up and down in silence, and I couldn't help thinking that neither of us was a shining example of attractive St. Mary's womanhood. Fat Piers seemed surprised to see me. I assumed he assumed William Hendred had ordered me to stay. We clustered in the doorway and watched. The big gate had been closed days ago, but now the little wicket gate was slammed shut and barred too. If I ever got back to St. Mary's, I fought down the by now quite accustomed panic. I must remember to tell Professor Rapson the big gate opened outwards and the little gate opened inwards. Walter of Shrewsbury withdrew into the hall. I heard the sounds of doors and shutters being slammed both upstairs and down. William Hendred stood in the courtyard shouting instructions. In this situation, control of St. Mary's had obviously passed to him. Men scurried hither and thither, clutching their weapons. Tam, the Welshman, William's second in charge, was leading his men towards the walls, where they took up their positions. William shot one last look around at the bolted and shuttered buildings and joined them, leaning out over the walls to see. The walls were crenellated, but were no more than 15 or 20 feet high. There was no moat on the other side, although the ground was boggy. I suspected even the smallest army would have no difficulty forcing its way in. This, however, was not a small army. There were no siege weapons, no... What do they call those people who dig under castle walls? Sappers? That's it. Not that it's important, because there weren't any here anyway. This was only a hostile neighbour and a group of hastily purchased local thugs taking advantage of the king's absence, as neighbours do. Once, long ago, before I came to St. Mary's, and when European travel was much easier than it is today, I worked on a dig in the Eastern Med. Four of us were billeted in a very dodgy-looking outhouse on a remote farm somewhere in the Taurus Mountains. Once a year, the farmer would summon his considerable family. They would go to his boundary fences, uproot the fence posts, and at a word from him, take 5 long paces forwards and replace the posts. At a stroke, he would have gained a sizeable tranche of land. They did it every year, apparently. It had acquired the status of a ceremony, and there was a giant family knees-up afterwards. The 5 paces forward strategy was obviously far too subtle for Guy of Rushford and his brother Gerald. They were going for the whole manor, thinking that when Richard returned, St. Mary's would be snugly ensconced within their own boundaries. No one would care, and everyone would have more important things to think about anyway. I wondered if this sort of thing was happening anywhere else around the country. Tam was shading his eyes. Famed for his long sight, he was counting. Around 15 mounted men and between 20 and 30 on foot seemed to be the total, and no siege engines. I felt absurdly cheerful. Well, that wasn't too bad. We had nearly 20 men here. Good men who would fight for their homes, whereas the Rushford forces must surely comprise either hired men who had no loyalties and would fight for whoever paid them, or sulky serfs who just wanted to go home. All we had to do was hold them off until Richard was overthrown. Henry Bolingbroke must surely have landed at Ravenspur by now. All over the country, men would be flocking to his banner. It was only a matter of time before someone turned up here to save us. All we had to do was stay quietly behind our walls, hold on, and not do anything silly. There was no need for any violence at all. All we had to do was wait. I heard the thunder of hooves grow closer. William glanced back briefly over his shoulder, saw us all clustered in the kitchen doorway, and gestured us back inside. Fat Piers chivied us into the kitchen, and not without some difficulty, because it was never closed during summer or winter, they got the door shut. We stood in silence, listening. Well, they did. Walter of Shrewsbury appeared suddenly and beckoned to me to follow him. I had a feeling this wasn't good. He led me back to the hall and pointed to the corner. I went and stood quietly, trying not to feel anxious. He had his doubts about me. I was a stranger. I was odd. I knew things I shouldn't. I'm convinced he was convinced I was some sort of spy, if not for the king's commissioners, then for the Rushfords. He said something to one of the men with him who peeled off to come and stand by me. This was bad news. Not only was I to be closely watched, but I was to be closely watched by the onion-smelling gate guard from the kitchen, the one to whom a masterless woman was a challenge. I refused to look at him as he stood grinning at me. I folded my arms in an unwomanly manner and stared at the floor, listening as hard as I could. Not that it did me any good. The walls were thick, and only the very loudest sounds floated through the shutters. I could vaguely hear shouting, so it seemed safe to assume we were being ordered to surrender St. Mary's. I wondered if the Rushfords would pretend they were acting under the king's orders, or whether they were just going for out-and-out theft. I had no details as to what would happen next, and the historical records I could remember were not accurate. If they were wrong, what else was wrong? Had my presence in some tiny but important way changed the course of events? I stood quietly in my corner, straining my ears for clues as to what was going on outside. I was certain I'd managed to convince William Hendred of Henry, Duke of Lancaster's, return. Obviously, I hadn't told him Henry would be king, but I'd emphasized over and over again that Henry would come back, bringing Hugh Armstrong with him. Knowing that, surely he wouldn't surrender St. Mary's without a fight. No, he wouldn't. I heard his voice shouting defiance. Other voices joined in, which was reassuring. If they were shouting at each other, then they weren't fighting. The shouting continued for some time, and then William appeared in the hall, looking about him. At the same time, Walter appeared through the other door and gestured to me. Onion Man pushed me forwards. There was no need. I was already moving, but I suppose it was the only way he would ever get to touch a woman. I stood in front of Walter, entirely forgetting the chaste, dutiful, obedient role of medieval womanhood.
"You, what do you know of this?"
"Nothing but what I have said, sir."
"How long have you known this?"
"Since I arrived, sir."
"Why are you here today?"
"This is the trouble with knowing things you're not supposed to, and then having to lie your head off. You have to think of everything. I had no idea why they hadn't turned up before today. I felt a stab of annoyance. I was trying to help them out here. I shouldn't have to think of everything." I shrugged. "I do not know, sir." William joined us, saying mildly, "It might have taken them some time to gather this force, but they are here now, and we must deal with them." Walter was not one to give up.
"How do we know this woman is telling the truth?"
His voice led everyone to believe only an idiot would involve a woman in their schemes. I looked over to William.
"We don't," he said mildly. "But she did not have to warn us." "She is playing both sides," said Walter, giving me considerably more credit for deviousness than I felt I deserved. "And now it is too late to send her away. She will go straight to Guy and his brother and tell them how things stand here."
I didn't like the way this was heading.
"You should make up your mind, Master Walter," I said. "Everyone here will remember that I tried to warn you of this on my first day here. You told me to be silent. You cannot now blame me for the events I did my best to warn you of."
Onion Man went to fetch me a casual slap.
"Be silent before your betters."
William Hendred knocked his arm away.
"No one touches this woman without my permission."
I glared at Onion Man. He glared at William. William glared back at Onion Man. Walter glared impartially at everyone. There was a long silence. And then a shout of warning, a long hissing sound, and a thunk. I'd heard that sound before, at Agincourt. The Rushfords had unleashed a volley of arrows over the wall. I could hear them clattering off the stonework outside and the roof over our heads. One or two thunked into the wooden shutters. They penetrated to some considerable depth. I remembered a good archer could put a cloth-yard arrow through a church door from 100 yards away. I don't know why I always remember these things at the wrong moment. I'm proud to say I didn't move. Actually, standing in my corner, I was probably the safest person in the room. But Onion Man flinched. He saw me grinning. "I just can't help it. I'm lost in time, in the middle of an armed conflict in the Middle Ages, alone, friendless, and whichever side won, I'd be in trouble, and as if none of that's bad enough, I'm winding up the bloke who's had it in for me since we first met. You can see why I can't get life insurance, can't you?" Over all the shouting, I could hear a deep booming noise, a pause, and then it came again. They had a battering ram. They had an actual battering ram. I must remember to tell Professor Rapson. And then I realized that I'd never tell Professor Rapson anything ever again. The shouting intensified. I could hear William Hendred bellowing instructions outside. He was concentrating his men over the gatehouse. They would be firing at those wielding the battering ram.
The noise arose to a crescendo, shouts of warning, shouts of defiance, and the rhythmical boom of the battering ram, which, I have to say, sounded considerably more effective than poor old Grond of happier days. Whatever William Hendred's men were doing to repel the attack was effective, though. The booming noise ceased. Silence fell. None of us was stupid enough to think they'd given up and gone away. I suspected they'd gone for a fast surprise attack, and now that had failed, they were setting up camp for a siege. It couldn't have happened at a worse time. Early summer is never an easy time. People think getting through the winter is the problem, but that's not true. Winter is usually not too bad. The harvest is gathered in, animals have been slaughtered and salted, and the storehouses are full. Then that's all gradually eaten away, and everyone crosses their fingers that their dwindling supplies will last at least until mid to late summer, when the crops and fruit are beginning to ripen. A bad harvest in the previous year can cause considerable hardship in the next. I don't know whether the Rushfords had taken this into account, or whether they were simply taking advantage of events, but, as I said, it couldn't have happened at a worse time. Our storehouses had been almost emptied. The remaining sacks of grain and flour, the stores of salted meat and fish, nearly everything had been taken away, partly to feed others and partly for safekeeping. But those of us who had remained behind had enough to get by, and we had strong walls and good men. Best of all, we had water. We would be fine. I looked around again. It was hard to see how anything could go badly wrong, but it would. Because I knew that the siege of St. Mary's ended in fire. Chapter 21. 2 days passed, and I have to say that after the initial excitement, being under siege is actually quite dull. Perhaps things were livelier on the other side of the wall, but in here, dull. Very dull. William kept the walls constantly manned. There was even someone at the top of the North Tower with instructions to scan the horizon, whether for reinforcements for the Rushfords or the possible return of Hugh Armstrong, I don't know. The shifts were short, 3 hours only, and then another set of men would take over. Those off watch ate and slept, as soldiers do. Eat when you can, sleep when you can, fight when you must. And then, on the third day, it all went wrong. I was still in the hall under Walter's watchful gaze. They fed me, a little, and I was allowed outside to visit our state-of-the-art midden, under escort, of course. At the time, I found it quite irksome and embarrassing, and then it turned out to be the best thing that could have happened for me. I awoke at dawn to find Roger from the kitchen handing me a beaker of weak beer and a bowl of porridge. I thanked him and tucked in. Draining the last of my beer, I stood up and requested a midden break because my guard had changed during the night and this one wasn't Onion Man. There was no way I would ever go outside and lift my skirts with him in the vicinity. My guard nodded, yawning, and we unbarred the door and stepped out into the cool early morning air. I stretched and looked around. Nothing had changed since my last comfort break. There were still men on the walls and another one up on the tower. Silent buildings huddled around an empty courtyard. Everything was shuttered or bolted or put away or covered over. I took 2 steps and then stopped. Something was different. I looked around. What was different? My guard poked me in the back to get me moving again. This was probably the end of his watch, and he was eager to get his head down. I turned to face him and said, "Wait, something is wrong." He was only a country boy, but he was William Hendred trained. He pushed me against the wall, put his hand on his sword and looked around. We both did. I pointed. There! The well was uncovered. Against all instructions, the well was uncovered. I felt a sick feeling in my stomach. We set off across the courtyard and peered in. Shit. Floating in the water, guts trailing like long red ribbons, dead as a doornail, was one of the stable cats. My guard's breath hissed through his teeth. This was a disaster, and it wasn't an accident either. I looked around. The well cover was nowhere in sight. Someone had been here in the night, removed the well cover, thrown in a more than dead cat, and then left the well open so everyone could see the water was no longer drinkable. There would be no point in continuing the siege. It was all over. A stupid nursery rhyme jangled in my head. Ding dong bell, pussy's in the well. Who put her in? I couldn't remember who put her in, but I knew it wasn't me. My guard was good. He said, "Wait here." I nodded and watched him set off for William, just now walking the walls and talking to his men. I saw my guard take him a little to one side and whisper discreetly in his ear. He didn't want to start a panic. The two of them climbed down the steps and leaned over the well. William's face didn't change. He stood staring into the depths, arms braced against the stone lip and thinking. After a moment he said, "Check the other well." The man nodded and trotted away to the scullery, which contained the second, smaller well. We stood together. Neither of us spoke. Around us, St. Mary's was waking to its third and last day's siege. I looked around. If the kitchen well was spoiled too, then we were finished. Apart from water drawn the night before, we would have nothing. There was beer in the barrels, but you can't cook with beer, or give it to the horses. How long could we last without water? Not long enough, was my guess. And who had done this? I couldn't help feeling a small measure of relief. No matter who might have done it, one person couldn't possibly be the guilty party, and that person was me. I'd been guarded all night. I had an alibi. I was the one person in all of St. Mary's who couldn't be blamed for this. Unless my guard lied. But why would he? If it had been Onion Man, then I wouldn't have fancied my chances of convincing people of my innocence, but he wasn't here. I looked around. No, he wasn't. Was he? Men were emerging from the gatehouse and making their way to the walls. Those who'd been on watch throughout the night were climbing down. Those who'd eaten were crossing the courtyard, and those who were about to eat were crossing in the opposite direction. Sleepy early morning greetings were exchanged. But there was one person who wasn't here. I couldn't see Onion Man anywhere. I turned slowly. No. No Onion Man in sight, unless... I tweaked William's sleeve and nodded in the direction of our plein air bathroom. He nodded curtly, his mind elsewhere. Onion Man wasn't there. I walked all around the steaming heap, several times in fact, before availing myself of the facility and returning to William. "He's not here." His gaze snapped at me. "Who is not here?" "The man who was my guard, not him." I gestured to the returning man. "The one who smells of onions." The guard rejoined us, whispering in William's ear. This time William's expression did change, and I knew that somehow the other well had been poisoned too. He snapped a curt command, and the three of us returned to the hall where Walter of Shrewsbury was waiting. William took him aside and spoke quietly, and I could see immediately who was Walter's number one suspect. He took a deep breath to accuse me, but before he could utter, William had him by the arm and was propelling him through the doorway into the private family quarters. This was not a matter for public discussion. They went first, then me, then my guard. We turned left into a large, sunny room I had never seen before. I had no time to notice anything other than the rather handsome red and black clay tiles on the floor before Walter rounded on me. I saw the blow coming and rode it as best I could, but his clenched fist caught me on the cheekbone and it hurt. It hurt a lot. Stringy he might be, but he packed a hell of a punch. I went down like one of those demolished factory chimneys, but with less style and more dust. I lay on the cold floor wondering whether I should get up so I could be knocked down again, or stay down so he could kick me more easily. It struck me that if I had an office job, then the only decision I'd be making at that moment would be whether to do my photocopying before my filing, or the other way around. Office jobs have many hidden benefits. Ian Guthrie's voice ran through my head. "Are you going to lie there all day, Maxwell?" He was right. I should get up and put in an honest day's work being their prime suspect. Get it over with, so to speak. If I couldn't convince them of my innocence, then in less than an hour I'd be hanging from one of the rafters in the hall as a warning to others. I climbed to my knees and from there to my feet. I didn't cry or put my hand to my face or plead for my life. Bollocks to all that. I was certain the man they wanted was Onion Man. I was equally certain he wasn't here any longer. He'd climbed out of an upper window hours ago. Nothing I could say was